You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, September 17th. I'm CJ from Drake University. Here's our first story. Mid-year chamber banquet highlights workforce, economic issues amid COVID-19. During Wednesday's Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce mid-year meeting, discussion revolved around local and state economic vitality amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. While attendees enjoyed lunch at socially distanced tables, new chamber president and CEO Drew Camp spoke of the importance of keeping local businesses relevant during trying times. Some of his focal points heading into the latter part of the year, he said, include promoting workforce development, business retention, expansion, and bolstering public policy. The advocacy arm. Advocacy is one of the biggest things that a chamber can do, said Camp, who took over the business organization's helm 7 weeks ago. And if you do it effectively, it's such a critical part of our overall organization. Whether that's at the local city council, county supervisors, state, federal, or even sometimes getting into international, it's all about assisting them with anything that they need on advocacy pieces. In regard to creating a strong business climate, leaders are needed, Camp said. One segment of the meeting was dedicated to recognizing the most recent graduates of the Leadership Council Bluffs program. The program is designed to identify and develop potential community leaders to enhance their leadership skills with greater knowledge of the community, its history, its challenges, and its successes, Camp said. There have been more than 650 Leadership Council Bluffs graduates over more than 3 decades, which continue serving on committees, boards, commissions, public office, and as volunteers in the greater Council Bluffs area, he added. Recognition of the Leadership Council Bluffs graduates. Keynote speaker Beth Townsend spoke about the current workforce environment at the state level. Townsend serves as the director of Iowa Workforce Development, one of the agency's Camp says works arm in arm with the local chamber. Townsend said Iowa's unemployment rate as of July, the most recent available figures, was 6.6%. This equated to more than 107,000 state residents out of work. But she also said there were more than 60,500 job openings as of Monday on Iowa Works' website, which she noted is encouraging. As with other states, the coronavirus pandemic has heavily affected business and employment opportunities. More unemployment claims have been filed in the past 6 months than in recent history. We've paid $881 million out of the trust fund since the beginning of March, Townsend said. That's almost double what we would normally pay during any calendar year. Hopefully, we will never see anything like this again in our lifetime, because certainly it's not the number of claims or the number of benefits that we would ever expect to pay out in a year, much less over a 6 month period of time, she added, though one major plus being seen, between 5,000 and 6,000 Iowans cutting ties with unemployment benefits weekly. That's a good sign, Townsend said. Camp said that Townsend was a solid, relevant choice to serve as the event's keynote. We really work with two state agencies predominantly. That's Iowa Economic Development Authority and Iowa Workforce Development, which is Beth Townsend and her staff, he said. We work a lot with them. Not only are they a critical partner, unemployment is one of their biggest apparatuses that they oversee in their operation. And that's been such a huge issue since the pandemic started. We wanted to give her the opportunity to come and talk through some of the things that they've experienced since the pandemic started. Overall, Camp said he was pleased with his first large-scale meeting as leader of the chamber. It served as an avenue to gather residents, all of whom wore masks when not eating or sitting at their tables, and educate them about some pressing issues both locally and statewide. Understanding these issues enables communities like Council Bluffs to evolve and grow, and the Bluffs is primed for more economic development, he said. There's a lot of areas that are ripe for growth, Camp said. There's short-term planning, mid-term, and long-term planning happening at the community level. And that's so important, because you can't just look at the current here and now, or short-term. You have to look at long-term if you want to make the community what you truly want it to be. Council Bluffs Schools outlines goals for school year. Council Bluffs Community School District officials outlined the district's comprehensive school improvement plan for 2020 through 2021 during a Board of Education meeting last week. The plan sets goals for students' academic achievement based on the superintendent's goals, building school improvement plans, and Iowa Department of Education targets. The CSIP provides a roadmap for our future on continuous academic achievement, Superintendent Vicki Murillo said. It is critical, especially with this pandemic, that we continue to monitor progress on student achievement goals. The school district evaluates academic achievement with the Measures of Academic Progress Assessment. All students in kindergarten through 11th grade take the MAP assessment every fall, winter, and spring, so the district can track improvement. Although last spring's closure because of the coronavirus pandemic prevented students from taking the spring test. Individual schools will design strategies for achieving the goals, which align with the district's 2017 through 2020 academic plan, Chief Academic Officer Corey Borthman said in a presentation to the board. Annually, each school develops a school improvement plan based on data analysis and district goals, he said. These plans are led by building principals in collaboration with teachers who serve on building leadership teams at each building. In general, the plan centers around three main goals for the school year. First, by the year 2021, 80% of students in kindergarten through third grade will be at or above state benchmarks on the Measures of Academic Progress Assessment. On the fall 2019 screening, 67% of students in kindergarten through third grade were at the benchmark, Borthman said. Second, by the winter 2020, 80% of students in kindergarten through sixth grade will be at or above benchmark on the MAP assessment. In winter 2020, 75% of students in those grades were at or above benchmark. And finally, third, by 2021, 80% of students in kindergarten through 11th grade will be at or above the average, or high levels on the MAP assessments in reading and mathematics. On the winter 2020 MAP tests, 63% scored in the average, or high level in reading, and 55% of students scored in the average, or high level in mathematics. Those who score in the average range or higher are considered proficient, Borthman said. In response to a question from a board member, Borthman said he did not know how much last spring's extended closure would affect test scores this fall. I don't know what to expect, he said. The Comprehensive School Improvement Plan is part of the district's process of continuous improvement, which focuses on instructional improvement linked to student learning, Borthman said. The plan must be submitted to the Iowa Department of Education. Reynolds defends using coronavirus funds for staff pay. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday there is nothing inappropriate about her decision to spend nearly $450,000 in federal coronavirus relief money on salaries for aides in her office, including her chief of staff and spokesman. Reynolds addressed the matter at a press conference for the first time since a report was published Sunday by Laura Bellin, publisher of the liberal-leaning online blog Bleeding Heartland. The report, based on information Bellin obtained through a public records request at the Iowa Department of Management, indicated 21 employees on Reynolds' staff will have had more than 60% of their salary paid with federal emergency funds from March 14th through June 30th. Reynolds said the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act allows salaries to be paid for workers whose job requirements are significantly changed due to the coronavirus pandemic. CARES funding can be used for salaries. That's very clear in what allowable allocations are, she said. She said when the first COVID-19 cases were identified in Iowa in early March, she moved half of her staff to a state emergency operations center to organize the state's response. They worked 9 to 10 hour days, 7 days a week on the virus, she said. The other half of her staff remained at the Iowa Capitol, working similar hours, answering questions, and working to meet the needs of Iowans, Reynolds said. The governor's office confirmed the expenditures with the U.S. Department of Treasury Office of the Inspector General, said Reynolds' chief of staff, Sarah Craig. Craig said the money hasn't shown up in CARES Act expenditure documents yet because the governor hasn't signed the transfer of money, but after she does, the spending will show up in public documents. It wasn't immediately clear what happens to the state money that had already been allocated to governors' staffer salaries. The amount sought from the federal funds for 21 governor's staff members will total $448,449, Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett confirmed. Senator Joe Bolcom, the senior Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, said Iowans should have confidence the federal COVID relief funds are being spent to help residents. Instead of using funds that are desperately needed to provide relief to hardworking Iowans and closed or struggling businesses hurt by the pandemic, the governor is diverting the relief fund for other purposes. That's not right, he said. While common uses for the money include testing and contact tracing, support for hospitals, and economic support for businesses, there does appear to be a use allocated to budgeted personnel and services diverted to a substantially different use in OIG documents. The OIG's office did not immediately respond to a message. Iowa Auditor Rob Sand has confirmed his office will audit CARES Act spending in Iowa. He declined to discuss any details, which he said will be contained in any report his office produces. Neither the governor nor the Republican majority legislature have granted media credentials for Bellin, who is open about the support for Democratic ideals. Reynolds' office did not respond to any of her questions about the spending over a two-week period. Also, at her press conference Wednesday, Reynolds criticized the Des Moines School District for not abandoning its online learning program and returning its more than 33,000 students to classrooms. She said other districts have managed to meet her requirement for in-person learning, even as the state remains a national hotspot for coronavirus infections. Des Moines officials argue it's too risky for students and staff to return to classrooms under Reynolds' orders. Education Department Director Ann Lebo said that officials would begin a process to potentially punish the district for not being in compliance, and students may be required to take additional classes after school usually ends next spring. As of Wednesday morning, Iowa had 775 new confirmed coronavirus cases in the last 24 hours, and one additional death. Sports dollars. Bluffs CVB receives grant to propel local athletics. A regional sports authority district grant provided by the Iowa Economic Development Authority is enabling the Council Bluffs Convention and Visitors Bureau to fund 9 large-scale sporting events from October through June. This is the 13th consecutive year the Bureau received the dollars, this time in the amount of $55,555, according to Organization Executive Director Mark Ekman. Other Iowa communities receiving funding are Ames, Cedar Valley, Greater Burlington, Greater Des Moines, Iowa City / Coralville, Quad Cities, Sioux City, and Dubuque. Previously, grant dollars have gone towards financing events like the NJCAA Men's Wrestling National Championship, Heartland USA Wrestling National Duels, Council Bluffs Wrestling Classic, King of the Mac, Halloween Havoc, Rumble on the River, River City Classic Gymnastics, 3SSB Basketball Tournament, and the Triple Crown Slump Buster Baseball Tournament. It allows us to assist sporting events in a way that we wouldn't be able to do through any other means, Ekman said during an interview with the Nonpareil. Our budget, while not a small amount of money, is probably not equal to what our counterparts in Dubuque receive at Travel Dubuque, or otherwise the Dubuque CVB. The same thing can be said of Iowa City. Both of those two convention and visitor bureaus have budgets of over $1 million, and ours is less than $500,000, less than that. Grants like these not only offset some budgetary constraints, Ekman said, they also help funnel cash into the Greater Bluffs community. In fact, travelers spend more than $350 million in Pottawatomie County in 2019, according to the U.S. Travel Association. Ekman said that moving into fiscal year 2021, fiscal year 2020 ended June 30th for reference, he and others are hoping for the going to be a bit smoother sailing and more financially advantageous. During fiscal year 2020, Ekman said 13 Bluffs sporting events were canceled, resulting in an estimated community impact of $20,968,937. If this would have been a normal year, we would have been able to assist 24 events that had an economic impact of more than $30 million for the number of attendees and the number of events. The hope is to right the ship this year, and the state-funded grant should play a part. It's something Ekman said he's grateful to receive again. "Not every community is that fortunate," he said, referencing Council Bluffs. "There have been years Dubuque and Des Moines and the Quad Cities have not received the grant, and they are genuinely annual applicants, so we don't take this for granted." No pun intended. Nonpareil to participate in statewide Iowa Mourns project. The Daily Nonpareil is working on a collaborative project with other newspapers across Iowa to tell the stories of those we've lost to COVID-19. The project, called Iowa Mourns, will tell the stories of their lives, who they were, how they lived, what they loved, and the impacts they had on their families, friends, and communities. Do you have a family member or close friend from Pottawatomie County who died from COVID-19? If you would like to participate in the Iowa Mourns Project, email editorial@nonpareilonline.com or call 712-325-5724. September 17th, face of the day, Aiden Allen. Aiden Allen is getting pumped up for middle school. Allen, 11, was born and raised in Council Bluffs. He is currently a fifth grader at Heartland Christian School, where he's spent all of his educational career. Aiden said Heartland Christian feels like home because his four siblings, first grader Levi, second grader Isaac, fifth grader Emily, and sophomore Anna, attend school with him, and his mom, Deb, also works there as a pre-K teacher. He said he enjoys being able to see his family in the school's halls throughout the day. Aiden is a modest kid, but elementary principal Justin Steinmetz has nothing but praise for the young man. "He's a great kid," he said. "He's always working hard. He loves being in school." Aiden said he's enjoyed his time in elementary school. He said he likes his teachers and he's made a lot of friends over the years. He said he's going to cherish the rest of his fifth grade year, but he's also excited about moving on to middle school next year. He said it will be interesting to have more freedoms that come along with growing up, as well as experiencing new teachers and classes. He also said he wants to get into athletics, and he's interested in playing football, baseball, and soccer. He said he doesn't really watch sports and said that he has more fun playing them himself. Aiden is a thrill seeker, and he had plenty of excitement this summer when his family took a trip to Adventureland in Altoona. He said his favorite ride was the Underground. The ride is set on a roller coaster track that rolls through a dark indoor space, mimicking a minecart ride. He had a pretty quiet summer otherwise, mostly playing football with his friends and spending time with family. Aiden only recently started the school year, but he's already getting excited for what the future has in store for him. Omaha Symphony announces Fall Festival of Centennial Concerts. Who are those masked musicians? That would be the Omaha Symphony String Section, taking the necessary precautions to play a concert amid the coronavirus pandemic. The All Strings Concert on October 3rd will be part of Centennial Overtures, a prelude to the orchestra's official 100th anniversary celebration that begins in January. The program is one of two to be held that weekend on the East Lawn of the Holland Performing Arts Center. It will feature the works of composers Jesse Montgomery, Gustav Holst, and Pyotr Tchaikovsky. The other is a concert of classical works made familiar by pop culture. The festival was planned by a committee of symphony leaders and musicians, with input from Omaha Performing Arts, which presents shows at the Holland and health guidance from the city of Omaha. "We worked very hard to come up with a fall offering that fits within the perimeters of what is safe in the pandemic," said Symphony Concertmaster Susanna Perry Gilmore, who was on the committee. "I cannot convey how happy my heart is that we are able to return to live music." The festival will consist of 9 performances at various locations around the city. It will begin with several pop-up concerts featuring symphony and brass ensembles on September 24th, 26th, and 27th. Other events include Carnival of the Animals, Dancing Cheek to Cheek, and a program highlighting Gilmore on Antonio Vivaldi's Four Seasons. A different version of the symphony's annual Christmas celebration is also in the schedule. Physicians Mutual, Home for the Holidays with the Omaha Symphony, is set for December 18th and 19th. A complete list of Centennial Overtures concerts can be found at omahasymphony.org. In an interview, Gilmore said she's thrilled about the entire festival, but is especially excited about an all Ludwig von Beethoven program. His third symphony, Eroica, is on the program. "It is such a triumphant and hopeful work," she said. "I can't think of a better piece to play right now for our spirits." Because of the pandemic, the concerts, especially those inside the Holland, will look somewhat different, Gilmore said. Musicians will be distant and will not share music stands. The number of tickets will be limited, so the audience will be socially distanced as well. The outdoor concerts are free. Tickets for the others will be available starting September 18th on the Symphony website. Seating outdoors will be limited to 95 lawn squares that accommodate up to 8 people each. Omaha Performing Arts has been working on state-of-the-art safety measures, including better airflow and touchless everything, Gilmore said. "We're all feeling very comfortable." She said community members and committee members and the other Omahans they worked with were united in their desire to bring back live music this fall in a way that's appropriate during the pandemic. "There is an overwhelmingly collective will to figure out how we can persevere safely with the arts," Gilmore said. "The connection that we will have with each other through live music making will make wearing masks worthwhile." Our view: Bell's Play Garden, a welcome addition to Council Bluffs. Youngsters throughout the metro will soon have another option for getting outside and having some fun, thanks to a pair of local families. Bell's Play Garden will sit on a 2,000-square-foot area on Tom Hannafin River's Edge Park on the Council Bluffs riverfront, with interactive play elements in vibrant colors and patterns that represent the Missouri River and unique topography of the Bluffs, according to an Iowa West Foundation, a funder of the project. "We think we can accomplish something special," Heather Tomasek told the Council Bluffs City Council during its Monday study session. "We agree." Tomasek and husband Rick Knutson have teamed with Dusty and Marlena Davidson to spearhead the project, contributing $200,000 toward the project. The Back to the River organization will contribute $100,000, with Iowa West matching those funds with $300,000. It's a win for Council Bluffs. This project is part of the Go Play initiative co-founded by the Knutson, Tomasek, and Davidson families, which aims to increase outdoor play opportunities in the metro area. The Davidsons were born and raised in Council Bluffs, and Heather Tomasek formerly worked for the City of Council Bluffs' Parks Department, managing the landscape architecture for Phase 2 of River's Edge Park. "The park is near and dear to me," Tomasek told the council Monday. Tomasek said she received researched playgrounds across the country, including taking a trip to Cincinnati while working with a company to design the area, with an eye toward making sure the play garden matches the existing aesthetics of River's Edge Park. "We believe the addition of a new play space is very appropriate," she said of the addition to the park, which will be near the pavilion. "For the play pieces, we wanted something iconic and memorable," Tomasek said. "The area will have cattails and a 15-foot-tall pelican with a slide, among the many features of the design." This Go Play initiative was founded with the hopes of returning the idea of play back to the park and the neighborhoods in the former Playland Park area, Tomasek said in a release. "Both our families have young daughters that love to spend time outside at various parks around the metro, so this is named in honor of them. We believe it will reintroduce a new play space that enhances one's sense of discovery and adds to the growing momentum at the riverfront." The playground is named after the family's daughters, Ella L. Bell Knutson and Annabelle Davidson. Tomasek told the Nonpareil the next step in moving the project forward is getting approval from the Army Corps of Engineers, which is required because of its proximity to the Missouri River levee. This could take 9 to 12 months. "The project, which does not require council approval because no city funds are being used, is not to exceed $600,000, Tomasek said. The city council was unanimous in showing its appreciation of the project. "This is an absolute ton of work and so thoughtful," Councilman Chad Hannon said. "A really cool project," Councilman Roger Sandow added. "A cool project indeed. Kudos to the Knutson, Tomasek, and Davidson families, Back to the River, and Iowa West, for coming together to give a gift to Council Bluffs that will be enjoyed for years to come." New box set has trove of rare unreleased Elton John songs. Elton John is opening up his vault and releasing an expansive collection of rarely heard and unreleased tracks. John announced Thursday that the 8-CD collection, Elton Jewel Box, will be released on November 13th. The collection includes Sing Me No Sad Songs, an unreleased studio demo from 1969. The Jewel Box collection includes 148 songs, 60 of them unreleased, that span recordings from 1965 to 2019 and his early collaborations with songwriter Bernie Taupin. Two of the CDs include songs specially chosen by John, along with narration about them by the 6-time Grammy winner. Hearing these long-lost tracks again, I find it hard to comprehend just how prolific Bernie and I were during the early days. The songs just poured out of us, and the bands were just unbelievable in the studio, John said in a statement. I always want to push forward with everything I do and look to the future, but having time during lockdown to take stock and pull these moments from my memory from each era has been a joy. No price for the collection was announced. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, September 17th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm CJ from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. There are currently no obituaries listed for Thursday, September 17th. Now for today's sports section. Changes name to honor tennis great Billie Jean King. The Fed Cup is changing its name to honor tennis great Billie Jean King, the woman whose lifelong battle for equality and social justice laid the foundation for generations that followed. The Billie Jean King Cup will become the first major global team competition to be named after a woman, the International Tennis Federation said Thursday. I'm still in shock, the 76-year-old King said of the tribute. It's really a privilege, and it's also a responsibility. It's wild, it's great, it's wonderful. The rebranding followed earlier changes to bring prize money in line with the Men's Davis Cup and coincides with the 50th anniversary of King's pioneering effort to launch a women's pro tennis circuit. We feel it's long overdue, ITF President David Haggerty said. All major team competitions, including Davis Cup, are named after men, and we think it's really fitting that the Women's World Cup of Tennis will be named after someone as iconic as Billie Jean King, who changed the face of women's sports. King and her peers, known as the Original Nine, risked their careers to start the Virginia Slims Tour. Their work led to the creation of the Women's Tennis Association in 1973 as the organizing body for women's professional tennis. King's early efforts led to the lucrative prize funds and multi-million-dollar endorsement deals enjoyed today by top players like Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka. Today, the players are living our dream, and we're thrilled for them, King said. Women's tennis is the leader in women's sports. We are also leaders in the fight for justice and equality. King won 12 Grand Slam single titles, including 6 at Wimbledon, but her most famous match came in 1973. When she beat 55-year-old Bobby Riggs 6-4, 6-3, 6-3 in the Battle of the Sexes. The match, considered to be a milestone in the promotion of women's equality, was watched on TV by millions around the world. King's association with the Fed Cup goes back to its founding, when she was a member of the U.S. team that won the inaugural tournament in 1963 at Queen's Club in London. Then, 19 years later, she recalled prodding her teammates, "This is history being made. We have to win it, so we always know we were the first. Come on," they said. "Oh God, not you again. We know what the deal is." King, as a player and coach, won the Fed Cup trophy 10 times, a record for an individual. She was appointed as the competition's first global ambassador in 2019. 16 nations competed the first time, whereas 116 entered for 2020. 12 teams play in the finals. The goal is to continue that outreach, and Billie, as an iconic figure who is so well known, can help us do that, Haggerty said. The Davis Cup, named for Dwight Davis, who played in the inaugural tournament in 1900, has more nations and 18 spots in its finals. I'd like to get more countries, King said. We have 116, the guys have 142. The cultures are different in a lot of countries. We're going to have a lot of work ahead of us to break things down. The Billie Jean Cup finals are scheduled for April 13th to 18th in Budapest, Hungary. King said she absolutely will attend in April unless there are coronavirus roadblocks. The 2020 finals for both tournaments were scrapped this year because of the pandemic, although qualifying nations will maintain their places for the 2021 finals. King, the winner of 39 Grand Slam titles in singles, doubles, and mixed doubles, said she's so fortunate to be honored by the ITF. She recalled the late tennis journalist Bud Collins proposing a Fed Cup name change years ago. He said it had a horrible name. I had heard then that they were talking about naming me, or Chris Evert, or maybe another player, King said. It never came to fruition throughout the years. I know how lucky I am and blessed. People have always championed me. King said she's proud of today's stars for taking strong stances in social justice. Every generation, King said, has something special to offer to this process. Drone lands in outfield at Wrigley Field, causing delay. Umpires hastily cleared the field during the game between the Cleveland Indians and Chicago Cubs on Wednesday night when a small drone flew into Wrigley Field over the bleachers and landed on the grass in deep left center. As Wilson Contreras came to bat with two outs in the bottom of the fifth and the game tied at two, the device was spotted over the left center stands. Before the drone landed, umpires rushed players into the dugouts. The blinking drone took off, hovered at about 100 feet, then pulled away and vanished past the vintage center field scoreboard. Following a 7-minute delay, Contreras resumed his at-bat and grounded out to end the inning. With Big Ten reversal, Trump aims to score in battlegrounds. President Donald Trump was quick to spike the ball in celebration when the Big Ten announced the return of fall football at colleges clustered in some of the Midwest battleground states critical to his re-election effort, declaring, "I'm the one who got the football back." But his efforts to reverse last month's decision to postpone fall sports in the conference because of the novel coronavirus were far from the only factor that led officials to change course. The Big Ten, one of the power conferences that drives the big business of college sports, was under enormous pressure to restart the season from athletes, parents, coaches, and college towns that rely on football Saturdays to fill restaurants and hotels and provide much-needed tax revenue. For weeks, Trump allied himself with the effort. He publicly and privately prodded the conference to reverse its August 11th decision to play football next spring. When the conference announced Wednesday it would begin play October 23rd under strict coronavirus prevention protocols, Trump was eager to capitalize politically. "I called the commissioner a couple of weeks ago, and we started really putting a lot of pressure on, frankly," Trump said at a news conference. Trump's advisor said the episode underscores how the president's unconventional style, his Twitter rebukes and rhetorical bluster, gets things done. "It is a moment that could help Trump on the margins in key states such as Pennsylvania, Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin, where schools are now scheduled to play their first games less than 2 weeks before Election Day," said Alex Conant, a Republican strategist. "There are voters who voted for him in 2016 who don't want to vote for him this time, mostly because they don't like him personally," Conant said. "Those voters need to be reminded why they supported him in the first place. It's issues like this where he takes a controversial position they agree with and delivers." The Big Ten reversal also syncs with Trump's efforts to suggest the nation is on the glide path to normalcy under his stewardship. The president has criticized Democrats who don't want football back for political reasons, and accused Michigan's Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, of keeping Michigan and Michigan State off the field. Left unsaid is that the 14 schools in the Big Ten have opted to scale back in-person learning and pleaded with students to stop partying and congregating in large groups as the U.S. death toll from the virus nears 200,000. And while Trump repeatedly decried the Big Ten, until Wednesday he had far less to say about the postponement of fall sports by the Pac-12, which includes universities in Democratic-leaning California, Colorado, Oregon, and Washington, as well as battleground Arizona. On Wednesday, Trump called on the Pac-12 to get going and resume play. Whitmer said the Big Ten decision to reverse course was made by members of the conference. She said she had spoken with other governors about the prospect of allowing spectators to attend games, but cautioned that COVID-19 is still a very real threat. If we want to preserve that as an option, we've got to be serious about masking up, she said. Big Ten officials cited improvement in same-day coronavirus testing capabilities as a key factor in their reversal. Asked about Trump's role in bringing about the about-face, Wisconsin coach Barry Alvarez said Trump made clear the Big Ten was important to him. I think he drew attention to Big Ten football and had a solution, Alvarez said. So how much that had to do with us being back on the field? I don't know that answer. Trump's campaign manager, Bill Stepien, S-T-E-P-I-E-N, was unequivocal. Americans in Big Ten country have Trump to thank. College football is an enormous part of Fall Saturdays for millions of Americans, and it is coming back, thanks in no small part to the leadership of President Trump, Stepien said. We know that Joe Biden would not have pushed for this, since he has looked for every reason to keep our country closed for as long as possible because he believes it would help him politically. After calling Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren on September 1st, Trump expressed confidence that players would be back on the field soon, tweeting that a return to play was on the one-yard line. He later suggested Whitmer, as well as Republican Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland and Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, were holding things up. Biden, for his part, tried to lay the blame for canceled sport events squarely at Trump's feet with an ad that aired days before Trump's call to the Big Ten commissioner. Trump put America on the sidelines. Let's get back in the game. Flashes on the screen, with images of empty stadiums at the University of Michigan, Michigan State University, and elsewhere. Trump on Wednesday slammed that ad as totally fake. Karen Kodrowski, a political scientist at Iowa State University, said the return of the Big Ten is good politics for Trump if the conference is able to carry out the season with minimal further disruptions and if relatively few athletes get sick with the virus. It's the sort of thing that will excite Trump's fan base to donate or argue their friends to go out and vote for Trump or remind them to send in their absentee ballots, she said. In some of these states where the races are expected to be very tight, you might not have to move the needle much to help make a difference. Tough test for tough times. U.S. Open at Haunting Winged Foot. When golfers fall asleep imagining how they'll play this course or that, they're almost never dreaming about Winged Foot. That includes Tiger Woods. The place is a nightmare for him, too. Then again, if the aim is to stage the toughest test in golf, in the midst of a pandemic, no less, where else would you plant the flagstick? Only two players have finished under par in the five U.S. Opens contested over the century-old design, and no one on the ground in Mamaroneck, New York this week, including the favorites, expects to make the serious dent in that legacy. Just the opposite. The viewers at home are going to see some pretty bizarre stuff, and probably a lot of putts and chips that make us look pretty bad, Justin Thomas said. If you're into that stuff, he added, then you're going to like this week. Which prompted at least one enterprising fan on Twitter to retort, why would I want to watch bad golf when I can do that to myself? A fair enough question, but one which the U.S. Golf Association rarely bothers to ask itself. The USGA selects the venues for the national championships and sets them up, sometimes diabolically, happy to let the game's three other major championships and nearly every week out on tour offer what amounts to a skeet shoot. Birdies have been plentiful since golf resumed play back in June. Six players have won with scores of 20 under par or better, including an eye-popping 30-under-par win by Dustin Johnson, the favorite at tee-off time, at the Northern Trust last month. The low scores could be a result of golfers using the extra time off to practice or just decompress, or maybe even a lack of fans applying pressure on the leader coming down the stretch. Whatever the reason, don't expect a lot of red on the board, or conversely, too much complaining by the players this week. It was at Winged Foot, not coincidentally, where the USGA's rallying cry was made by the late Sandy Tatum, its president at the time, after a particularly brutal opening round in 1974. We're not here to humiliate the best players, he said. We're simply trying to identify who they are. Along with Johnson and Thomas, several other guys on impressive runs are being touted by the bookies, few gaining more buzz than John Rahm. The Spaniard, by way of Arizona State, has already notched the two toughest tournaments this year, the Memorial at Muirfield Village and the BMW Championship at Olympia Fields, holding off loaded fields in both, and is poised for his major breakthrough. With tight fairways, thick rough, slick greens, and five closing par fours of 420 yards and better, Winged Foot places a premium on driving accuracy, distance control with the irons, and especially the short game. That could bring young Colin Morikawa, the recent crowned PGA Championship winner and just turned 40 Aussie Adam Scott into the mix. Most of the top 70 ranked players in the world will be on hand, including three-time winner Woods, defending champion Gary Woodland, and eight other U.S. Open winners. Missing is Brooks Koepka, who won back-to-back in 2017, 2017, and 2018, but will sit this one out due to an injury. Woods, seeking his 16th major, claims the U.S. 2000 title at Pebble Beach with a performance that ranks among the greatest 4 days of golf ever played. Now 44 and day-to-day because of a surgically repaired back, he might have trouble just hanging on to this weekend. When the 1997 PGA Championship was played at Winged Foot, Woods finished T29. In the previous U.S. Open there in 2006, weeks after the death of his father, Earl, he missed the cut. Phil Mickelson, the other aging superstar, has an even more tortured history at Winged Foot. Having just turned 50 and dominated in his first Champions Tour start, he spent most of the week recounting his improbable meltdown in 2006, one of a half-dozen runner-up finishes he's collected chasing the one major championship that has eluded him. But at least he's having fun with it. In a TV ad running recently, Mickelson promises a free driver to a lucky contest entrant, whose favorite Callaway golfer wins the U.S. Open. "Come on," Phil says in the promo, "we all know who it's going to be. When have I ever let you down at Winged Foot?" Real confidence helps Adams succeed as Rodgers' top target. The age gap separating Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers and wide receiver Davante Adams was evident from one way they communicated this week. Rodgers and Adams were sitting in the Packers locker room Wednesday when the 27-year-old wideout sent a text message to the veteran quarterback. "It's this generation now," the 36-year-old Rodgers quipped. "They'd rather send a text across the locker room than walk across." They may prefer different methods of communication, but Rodgers and Adams have developed quite the relationship on the field. Adams caught 14 passes from Rodgers in a season-opening 43-34 victory over the Minnesota Vikings to tie Don Hutson's 78-year franchise record for receptions in the game. Adam also scored twice and now has an NFL-leading 42 touchdown catches since 2016. That's a remarkable rise for a guy who totaled just 4 touchdown catches in his first 2 seasons. Yet Rodgers says he could tell even then Adams had the confidence to develop into a special player. "I think some guys step on the field and believe they're the best player on the field, and a lot of it is bravado and false confidence, their own kind of rebuttal to the insecurity they may feel about their own abilities or abilities to perform at this level," Rodgers said. "There's been a few guys over the years who have had real confidence. Davante Adams has since he got here." Rodgers said he can distinguish which people have real confidence rather than false bravado by how they respond to adversity. Adams offers a similar perspective. "Some people, when they go through tough times, they start to question themselves and their abilities and what they bring to the table and what they can do and how everybody else views them," Adams said. "But when you have full, real confidence in yourself, you just look at certain setbacks or certain things that happen as just something that happened, rather than it's a part of who you are and it's going to factor into your next move or whatever." Even with all that confidence, Adams acknowledges that he needed time to feel comfortable initiating the conversations with Rodgers that former teammates Jordy Nelson and Randall Cobb had often conducted with the veteran quarterback. Adams hoped to develop a similar type of kinship with a two-time MVP, but didn't want to come across the wrong way. "It was always something he had encouraged," Adams said. "He wanted me to come and talk to him, share thoughts throughout the week, throughout the game, but I didn't necessarily want him to think I'm calling for the ball or doing this. As we went along a little bit longer and got used to each other and got to know each other really well, he knew where it was coming from. He understood my football IQ and just started trusting me and trusting my eyes out on the field, and I think that spread throughout the coaches as well." Now they're at a point where Adams isn't shy about suggesting routes to Rodgers during the game. "It's extremely gratifying when it's 3rd and 6 and I say, come out of nowhere and tell him the route that I think I want to run on 3rd down. And we run it and it works," Adams said. "That's how that trust is built up, and that's what's gotten us to the point we're at now." Rodgers and Adams could be facing a secondary dealing with uncertainty for the 2nd straight week. Green Bay torched a Vikings defense whose 3 main cornerbacks were all 23 or younger. Detroit has its own cornerback issue with hamstring problems, putting Justin Coleman on injured reserve and preventing Desmond Trufant from practicing Wednesday. Rookies first-round pick Jeff Okuda, another Lions quarterback, was a full participant in Wednesday's practice and could make his NFL debut Saturday after missing a season-opening loss to Chicago with a hamstring injury. Adams says he doesn't focus much on an opponent's injury situation as he gets ready for a game. He just concentrates on helping make sure the Packers are at their best each Sunday. That includes these frequent conversations with Rodgers, whether in person or by text. We'll do stuff like that, where something will be in my head, and maybe it's not the time to talk in person, but I've got something I want to share, or whatever, Adams said. We do that all the time. He's an open book, and same with me, so that's just kind of how we function. Note, Packers defensive tackle Kenny Clark didn't practice Wednesday due to a groin injury that knocked him out of the Vikings game in the first half. The Packers signed offensive tackle Ryan Pope and defensive lineman Billy Wayne to the practice squad, and they released defensive lineman Dalen Mack from the practice squad. New Japanese Prime Minister gets word out. He supports Tokyo Olympics. Japan's new Prime Minister has gotten the word out to the President of the International Olympic Committee that he is behind next year's delayed Tokyo Games. Yoshiro Mori, head of the local organizing committee and also a former Prime Minister, said Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga has a strong commitment to the Tokyo Olympics. Mori said that was the message he conveyed on a call to IOC President Thomas Bach. Mr. Bach was very pleased when he heard this, Mori said. Speaking on Thursday at the organizing committee offices, he said he wanted to fly over immediately and thank Mr. Suga for it. Tokyo organizers say the games will open on July 23, 2021, despite the coronavirus pandemic, but they have given few details about exactly how and at what added costs. They have said specifics about fans, quarantines, border control, and testing will not be forthcoming until the end of the year, or even into early 2021. Mori told Bach, the reappointment of the two ministers directly connected to the Olympics, Education Minister Koichi Hagiuda and Olympic Minister Seiko Hashimoto, showed the government's continued support. Making the Olympics and Paralympics a success, using all means, is the strong commitment of Japan, Hagiuda said, speaking alongside Mori. There are many challenges, but as the minister in charge, I would like to do my utmost to solve them, one by one. Hashimoto, an Olympic medal winner, said her focus was the athletes. I think making environments where athletes can respect each other and compete to the best of their ability is the most important, she said. To wrap up, we have some coronavirus updates. Trump versus the health experts on vaccine distribution, mask effectiveness. Get the latest. Openly contradicting the government's top health experts, President Donald Trump predicted Wednesday that a safe and effective vaccine against the coronavirus could be ready as early as next month, and in mass distribution soon after, undermining the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and calling him confused in projecting a longer time frame. Trump also disagreed with Dr. Robert Redfield about the effectiveness of protective masks, which the president recommends but almost never wears, and said he'd telephoned Redfield to tell him so. Earlier in the day, the CDC sent all 50 states a playbook for distribution of a vaccine to all Americans free of cost when one is proven safe and effective, which is not yet the case. Redfield told a congressional hearing that healthcare workers, first responders, and others at high risk would get the vaccine first, perhaps in January or even late this year. But it was unlikely to be available more broadly, again assuming approval, before late spring or summer. Here's an update on all developments. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits fell last week to 860,000, a historically high figure that reflects economic damage from the coronavirus outbreak. Joe Biden said Wednesday that while he trusts what scientists say about a potential coronavirus vaccine, he doesn't trust President Donald Trump. President Donald Trump parachuted into the coronavirus aid debate Wednesday, upbraiding his Republican allies for proposing too small of a relief package and encouraging both parties in Congress to go for a bigger one that would include his priority of $1,200 stimulus checks for most Americans. The World Health Organization's European director warned national governments Thursday against reducing the quarantine period for people potentially exposed to the coronavirus even as he acknowledged that COVID-19 fatigue was setting in. Attorney General William Barr drew sharp condemnation Thursday for comparing lockdown orders during the coronavirus pandemic to slavery. Some reporting exclusions could explain why India, which has recorded more than 5.1 million infections, second only to the United States, has a death toll of about 83,000 in a country of 1.3 billion people. U.S. housing construction fell a surprising 5.1% in August, after 3 months of strong gains when home builders ramped up projects following a pandemic-induced shutdown in March and April. The latest. Ex-CDC leader concerned by politics in science. Former CDC Director Tom Frieden says he's concerned about political pressure on the science of the coronavirus pandemic. Frieden told CBS This Morning, the FDA and the CDC have been unduly influenced by politics when it comes to the emergency approvals, when it comes to recommendations. He said it's very problematic because we want to have a safe, effective, acceptable, and trusted vaccine. President Donald Trump disagreed on Wednesday with current CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield about how soon a vaccine would be accessible, if one becomes available, and the effectiveness of protective masks. Frieden says he's alarmed some information on the CDC website isn't scientifically justifiable, and written not at the CDC headquarters in Atlanta, but in Washington by people who have no special experience in public health. And it's unfortunate, because there are thousands of really good documents on that website. It's had 1.6 million clicks, and you need to be able to trust it. WHO Europe chief urges nations to keep up COVID quarantines. The World Health Organization's European director warned national governments Thursday against reducing the quarantine period for people potentially exposed to the coronavirus, even as he acknowledged that COVID-19 fatigue was setting in with growing public resistance to the measures needed to control the pandemic. Dr. Hans Kluge said that even a slight reduction in the length of the quarantine could have a significant effect on the spread of the virus, which returned to alarming rates of transmission in Europe this month. Kluge insisted that countries should only reduce the standard 2-week quarantine period if it was scientifically justified. He offered to convene scientific discussions on the issue if necessary. WHO Europe's 53-country region recorded more than 300,000 confirmed coronavirus cases in the last week, and more than half of the countries reported a rise of more than 10% in cases over the last 2 weeks, he said. Of those countries, 7 had their cases jump by more than twofold. Such statistics should be a wake-up call for all of us, Kluge said. He called for regional coherence and said that Europe's response has been effective when prompt and resolute, but the virus has shown to be merciless wherever partisanship and disinformation prevailed. Last week, France cut its required quarantine time for people possibly exposed to someone with COVID-19 from 14 days to 7, saying that many people did not observe the 2-week full period anyways. Katie Smallwood, WHO Europe's senior health emergency officer, said its recommendation that people quarantine themselves for 14 days after a possible exposure was based on the agency's understanding of the disease's incubation period and transmission periods. We would only revise that on a basis of a change in our understanding of the science, and so far that's not the case, she said. Smallwood added that several countries were considering reducing their required quarantine periods, a move that is not endorsed by WHO. We would really reemphasize that our position is that a 14-day quarantine is important for patients that have been exposed to the virus, she said. During a press briefing with both Substance and Symbolism, the two WHO Europe officials both wore masks during a video conference from Copenhagen. The decision was a marked statement compared to a news conference held an hour earlier at WHO's world headquarters in Geneva, where neither Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, his emergencies chief, Dr. Michael Ryan, nor any other officials were masked. Switzerland and France, which all but surround Geneva, both have reported the surge in confirmed virus cases in recent weeks. Kluge said his decision to wear a mask was a clear signal that we are going into a worsening situation. At the moment, we see a fatigue and resistance in the behavior that is helpful in fighting the virus, he explained. It's very important to give a signal, and certainly it's a strong sign of solidarity. Kluge said that past successes in Europe suggested the continent would be again capable of suppressing the virus's recent rebound. In the spring and early summer, we were able to see the impact of strict lockdown measures. Our efforts, our sacrifices, paid off. In June, cases hit an all-time low, he said. The September case numbers, however, should serve as a wake-up call for all of us. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, September 17th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any IRIS programs, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm CJ from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening!